are back with episode 730 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I think we need a break, so I think all of you out there need to talk amongst yourselves for a while.
Is that how this works? How do we record that, though, Edmund? I'm really confused about this. I'm not sure that that's the best of ideas. Have we even found out if they can host a show? I don't know. We're just going to go ahead, I think, and we'll go through some of the feedback that you've given us. That seems to be the best way to handle this.
Oh, okay. Yes, that'll work.
Then we'll talk about some open topics, and then we'll see if maybe at that point we can hear back from some of our friends and see if they are really up to snuff in order to kind of take over for a little while. But let's leave that one alone. All right. We are obviously towards the end of a long week, and as everybody knows, I'm kind of delirious at this point, but we're going to keep paving forward, and we are going to talk about some, as I said, listener feedback, some of the things that we've been up to other than what I already talked about the last couple weeks, and who knows beyond that. But first, Edmund, a general disclaimer, just...
Whatever we're discussing, we might discuss details you haven't heard, and if that happens, then you will have been spoiled.
That's right. And, there are a couple things here that if you haven't seen them, you probably will be spoiled, and quite frankly, I think some of these are probably going to spoil me a little bit, but that's okay. I'm all right with that. As usual, our friend S. Elliot Fisher has given us some good feedback, and definitely want to thank him for that. There's going to be a lot to discuss here. And I just want to thank everybody who has been visiting our Facebook page, because we've been getting some nice amounts of people going over there and taking a look. As usual, most of the time, we do put up links to all of the stories that we talk about. So usually if we talked about it here, it's already been up on our Facebook page. And we also put other things that we don't talk about here on the podcast up on that on the Facebook feed for our show. So really, please go over there fairly often and see what we post up there, because who knows, maybe you will give us some feedback on one of those articles that we can use here. That's always something that I would love to see happen. All right, well, we are going to go ahead and get into the feedback, as I mentioned. And the first one here is a Midsummer report card, as Elliot Fisher puts it. Here's what he has to say. Okay, so this is a little late on my part, as work had been an unexpected distraction this summer. Yes, work can distract, especially when they send you places.
Yes.
To me, summer film season runs a little over 4 full months, from Free Comic Book Day until Labor Day. This year had definitely far more movies I was interested in than previous years, which usually contained one or two super tentpole products that scared away any other serious contender. With that said, I was able to get through 4 features for the first half of the summer and hope to see 4 to 5 more in the second half. So here are my first 4 in order that I've seen them. Okay, so he gives Captain America Civil War an A+. He says, this by far has been my favorite film of both the summer and year so far. Most third acts in a trilogy series usually fall flat, but Civil War manages to stay almost at the same level as Winter Soldier. It may have helped that as a former heavy reader of Marvel Comics, I knew and understood the backstory and motivation of most of the characters involved, but not having read Civil War or any of the recent big Marvel Universe stories, I didn't come in with expectations about the plot. The airport battle perfectly captured the true spirit of comics, possibly for the first time. It felt more like I was reading an issue of Captain America than watching a film adaptation of Captain America. So yeah, what do you think of those comments about Civil War, thinking back to when we saw it?
Certainly, I did enjoy the way it was keeping that continuity from Winter Soldier, certainly in terms of the sort of machinations and the politics, thinking of it in terms of meshing in with Ultron as well, it does feel like on the cinematic universe side of things, they are actually managing to bring a little bit of that sort of old school Marvel versus DC sensibility, where there was that sense for when Marvel hit its heyday they could go a little closer to the bone and a little sort of closer to real life. I mean, not that it's the real world; it is still the comic book world. world. But yeah, certainly with the way they're bringing the conflict in, it does feel the way things would play out if we did actually have to deal with this sort of silly over the top stuff.
Yeah, to me, it just felt like the culmination of so many plot threads, and a great way to kick off this kind of phase three, I guess, is what they're referring to it at this point. Yeah, it's kind of like, here's where we were, here's the implications of that, and here's where it's sending us in the future. And yet, at the same time, it did feel like it brought a lot of pieces full circle from the first Avenger. And I really can't complain about that. Certainly, I thought that it was a great installment, and I actually feel like maybe comparing it to Winter Soldier at this point, with a little bit of remove, does it need to be compared to Winter Soldier? I don't know that it does. I guess I understand why, but at the same time, there's a lot of differences between them in terms of the tone that they're trying to set. So, for me, Civil War. Probably the thing that surprised me the most was that for a movie with so many characters in it, it never really felt like anyone was ignored. Everybody got their moment. And that's a pretty big thing to say in retrospect. Because let's think about it. How many times have there been too many characters, whether it be heroes or villains, in a story, and somebody gets left behind, and way too often it's something really important to the mix of the characters? Usually the main character kind of somehow gets left behind in all of that. But I really feel like this was the one movie where everybody got their due. And that was an important step for them to take, especially having announced, as we heard just a couple episodes ago, or recently anyway, that there are so many characters that are going to be in the next Avengers film.
Yes.
If we have the same directors and the same producers involved in it, now we have a test case for that that worked about as well as one could ever hope. So, yeah, I really agree that Civil War knocked it out of the park. All right, next on the list here from S. Elliott Fisher, we have comments on X-Men Apocalypse, which he gives an A. Not quite a strong third act as Civil War, but a damn good film nonetheless. I really love Jennifer Lawrence's performance in this film as Mystique, despite the director's attempts to portray her more like Katniss. Despite this, the final chapter in the prequel trilogy really felt like all three films were meant to be the story of Mystique as she struggles to find her own philosophy on the mutant question while engaged in a tug of war between Charles and Eric's beliefs about the future of mutants. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. What do you think of that?
I can. He brings up an interesting point. I mean, I do wonder. I can see having that sort of interpretation, but I do feel a little bit like it was something that was sort of perhaps shoehorned in a little bit, because I don't think they necessarily intended Mystique to be that much of a focus, and I think there may have been something where the Jennifer Lawrence's stardom as things progressed may have been part of what was pushing that, but certainly the way the way those three films did work themselves out, I can certainly by this most recent film, I mean they were certainly pushing that angle, and certainly with Mystique as at least a role model, if not leader for that that next generation.
Yeah, you do get that. I mean, that was where it ended up, and so it certainly ended things in a way that is very different than the other films in the franchise left her. So I don't know how they line up at this point. The end of Days of Future Past pretty much said that they're never going to.
Yes.
This kind of doubled down on that in a million different ways. There's no way that could be the future of this timeline in any way. Certainly mutants and everything else would not be nearly the kind of like underspoken subject that it was in the first X-Men film after the Apocalypse matter has taken place. But Mystique kind of being the through line for these films, certainly I think that I'm not sure if it was because of Jennifer Lawrence and her kind of stature or what, but I do feel as though that was meant to be something that they explored, but I'm not so sure that they did it enough to say that it was the intent, like the primary intent. I'm also not too sure, since we know that the next film is going to take place in the 90s, is this truly a... As much as I said that it was when we talked about it, is this really the end of a trilogy?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the end of a trilogy because we have a lot of reason to believe that McAvoy and Fassbender and Lawrence are unlikely to show up next time.
Right.
So how that's going to work, I don't know. But storyline-wise, I mean, they've introduced a lot of people that I guess you could say they could maybe kick off another trilogy. They could, but it seems like they're just going to continue on at a certain pace from here. So maybe for the characters it's a trilogy, but I don't know if overall the franchise this was a trilogy, so to speak. I'm kind of on the fence about that. But maybe then in terms of Mystique as her three-film character arc, yeah, I do feel like they did explore the tension between her and between Xavier and Magneto. In the first timeline, it was pretty clear which way she went. It seems like in this timeline, she went the complete opposite way. They kind of get to have their cake and eat it too, which is pretty nice from a writer's point of view. But maybe that's part of the reason why it sounds a little bit rambling. What I'm saying is that I don't know where they're going to go with this franchise, because has anything about this franchise been conventional or straightforward?
No.
So... but no, I do believe that at least on the character basis, that this has been a nice journey for Mystique. And Jennifer Lawrence, as much as maybe she went into it with more enthusiasm and then maybe wasn't quite as enthusiastic because her star has risen enough that she doesn't really need this kind of high-profile role anymore, I still feel like she wasn't phoning it in as so many people thought that she was. I thought that she did exactly what she was supposed to do given the circumstances. So... Do you have any other thoughts, clarifying thoughts, or just in general?
No. I mean, since we wound up sort of talking about them in close proximity, I mean, I think so, certainly given the sort of semi-nebulous nature of these franchises, where there's always the question of who's available and as we were just mentioning whose star has risen and who isn't available and that sort of thing. It can be difficult sort of see, you know, whether this is a trilogy or ongoing story. But they do seem to have these distinct eras, and I think it's certainly interesting that by the end of Civil War and by the end of Apocalypse, we certainly have a whole bevy of potential replacements who have been trotted out to be used as the franchise holders see fit next time around.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. And I guess if I were to say the difference from my perspective between, say, Civil War and X-Men Apocalypse, which both of them end a trilogy, so to speak, but also clearly point the way towards the next phase of the story.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I think the difference is that I don't foresee there being any new Captain America movies per se. I think that story has been told, and now anything to do with him in the future will be in the Avengers films, where I feel like the X-Men franchise is going to just keep going. So it's a little bit different animal.
Mm-hmm.
The Captain America films were a sub-thread within the larger MCU. The X-Men films are the X-Men films.
Right, right.
They're trying to change that. I mean, certainly Deadpool is kind of in its own little niche, little nook and cranny.
Yes.
Its
own special little dark alley, ready to jump out at you when you least expect it.
I was going to say, it's in the ass crack of the X-Men universe. Which doesn't dispute what you said at all. But no, that is kind of off in its own little world, which means that... Many have said that the main X-Men films really aren't going to involve him because they can't.
Mm-hmm.
He's in his own little sub-thread there. Similarly, they want to have the New Mutants film. They want to have an X-Force film, perhaps. They want to have Gambit, if that ever actually happens. So they do have this idea of there being these kind of sub-films with their own, perhaps, story. But that would be closer to the Captain America mold than, say, directly trying to tie it or compare it to the X-Men main line. But that's, again, that's so complicated in terms of the X-Men films. I mean, there's just so many ways that it's supposed to be one multiverse and it doesn't really add up. So, yeah, I mean, it's got that kind of Chris Claremont hand waving. Yep. Don't worry. It'll all make sense. Kind of continuity. But I don't know that I see this. This may be like a sub trilogy within the larger narrative, but I think that's why I am reluctant to really see that as being a structural truth, because of the fact that it's just going to keep going. Mm-hmm. But we've kind of beaten that one into the ground. The next couple here, I don't know if either one of us saw these films, so we'll get into that. Maybe we did, maybe we didn't. I'm fairly sure we didn't see this one, though. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadow. S. No. Elliott Fisher gives this one an A. So, on par with Apocalypse.
Okay.
And the way that he puts it is, by far the greatest tragedy of the summer box office. Although this film failed to make back its cost domestically, it is in actuality most likely the best turtle film ever made. As my adult son put it, it's as if they went back and learned from everything they did wrong in prior films and actually fixed it. In many ways, the latest installment in the franchise is a redux of Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze, except a vast improvement. The best comparison would be Star Trek. Imagine if Into Darkness had come out in 1982 and Wrath of Khan was the remake released in 2013. Oh,
boy.
That's so wrong. And yet, yes. I kind of understand what he's trying to say.
It makes perfect sense in its own weird way, yes.
It does, doesn't it? I did not see that film, S. Elliott Fisher. In fact, I did not see the previous film in the quote-unquote remakes here. But it's interesting to hear you say that. I guess if you're a fan, that this was the movie that you were hoping for, and yet it didn't do too well domestically. I'd be curious to see if it did pretty well internationally and whether it turned a profit, because as we know, domestic box office, not quite the important thing that it used to be. But I'll look that up. Well, Edmund, do you have any comment on this?
I'm afraid, the Turtles craze is something that kind of passed me by. So I am really not in a position to really comment. I will say that I did have quite a bit of fun with all of those turtle promos that, of course, were flooding Arrow given the Stephen Amell connection. But it still didn't quite convince me to make it into the theaters.
Now, according to this, it really did flop domestically. It only got $82 million versus the $135 million budget.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take into account your foreign box office, the total worldwide was around $240 million. So it cleared its budget internationally.
Yeah.
Which is a far cry from the previous film, which, made twice as much. So I would think that the studio probably feels like this is a bit of a flop, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yes. It does.
Yes.
I would think so.
Yeah, but all right. I guess creatively it was a winner. All right. And then we have, finally, Independence Day Resurgence, which he gives a B+. He says, the film was surprisingly enjoyable and the story just flew. When the end credits started rolling, I had to check my watch. I never expected to like this film. I came to see the train wreck. It was purely a popcorn flick, though, so don't go looking for anything insightful or reflective here. This is sci-fi intended for the Pokemon Go crowd. Oh, hey. Not the Ingress crowd, though, although I'm sure they'll enjoy this break from thinking, too.
Mm-hmm.
I am giving you a look here, S. Elliott Fisher. Just saying. Anyway, as with all Emmerich films, it's fun to see which classics they're ripping off. Homaging in his films. This time around, I think he may be borrowing from anime, as I see elements of Robotech, a multi-generational space war, and Star Blazers, an alien invitation to travel across the galaxy for tech to save the Earth. Though my knowledge of anime is very limited, so if anyone sees any other homages in ID 4.2, let me know. That description broke my brain. ID 4.2. What? Okay, look you. The Pokemon Go nut. Okay, no. I completely understand. I mean, the game Ingress was definitely the precursor to Pokemon Go, and used a lot of the same stuff, and it was a very different thing. They simplified it greatly for the all ages crowd. I will not dispute that in any way. but still, I know that was intentional because I was talking about Pokemon Go so much. Edmund, your thoughts? I mean, I haven't seen this film either, so I don't know. Popcorn movie shopping at any time?
Yeah, no. Well, unfortunately for me and much of Roland Emmerich's output, I do tend to wait for it to pop up on other video outlets than actually going to the movie theater. Although certainly, you know, the this one I was almost tempted by just given the old ID4 penchant for explosions and over the top stuff, but I die in the end I decided no, it should just be that thing that I happen across one Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, right. Another movie that flopped domestically, made $384 million worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
On a $165 million budget.
Yeah.
Somehow I don't think that that's going to be quite the take that they were looking for when the previous film made once again practically twice as much on half the budget.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I think that that's probably being considered a bit of a flop as well, unfortunately for them. But it's good to have these comments. It's good to have this insight into the films. And thank you, S. Elliot Fisher, for that. He did, however, also give us some thoughts on another film. Let's see how he thinks about Star Trek Beyond. We know that he felt like he was pretty much going to give up on the franchise after the whole fan film controversy.
Mm-hmm.
But he did go and see the film, and he has these observations. The soundtrack, there seemed to be a hint of Jerry Goldsmith and possibly some James Horner mixed into Michael Giacchino's work.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely liked it, a great balance between nostalgia and new. I have to say, I noticed the same thing. I also noticed how he was interweaving some of the themes from the first two Kelvin timeline films. How about you, Edmund?
Actually, I've still only seen it the once, so I wasn't necessarily paying as much as close attention to the score as I might on a later viewing. From what I remember of it on the one viewing, that was another element that was feeling a little closer to some of that original series stuff.
Yes, indeed, I would agree with that. Next, he says, "A space station, Yorktown. I'm fairly convinced that the creators of Inception were hired to design Yorktown." maybe. Maybe. One thing that's interesting about that is that they actually used some of the skyline from Dubai, I believe.
Oh, yes.
In order to generate some of those effects. Sound effects. Specifically in regards to Yorktown, I think someone borrowed from ILM's Coruscant sound effects files, and I'm okay with that. He says, "I often feel guilty when I see a movie for free. Thank you, TWC and Epix." And I'm guessing that's Time Warner Cable.
Yes.
"And I really enjoy it. I'm feeling very guilty right now." So, see, that's his backhanded way of acknowledging that he really liked the film.
Yes.
A sign that, as he says here, a sign of exposed my wife to too much sci-fi. She keeps referring to Krall as evil Jakar. Okay. I completely get that.
Yes.
And to Jayla as white Darth Maul. can't ask why people are white. What's wrong with you? Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think one of my comments was that maybe not how Jakar looked eventually, but if you go back to the original pilot film,
definitely
you see the similarities between Jakar and Krall. She also feels the conflict in Beyond is a reflection of the conflict in Babylon 5, that is, order versus chaos.
Mm-hmm.
She feels Krall's group represents the shadows and Federation is the Vorlons.
Of course.
I agree as well. I do see the elements she speaks of in the film. We'll get into that in a moment, I'm sure, and
I do have to say, very, very nice crossing of the streams. I mean, actually managing to get the big three all together.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. Just kudos to your wife. She managed to pull it off. And finally, he says, the riddle has finally been solved. How does someone other than Kirk get the girl? They write the script themselves. That's some fine social engineering, Scotty. I raise my glass to you, laddie.
Yes.
Nicely said, S. Elliot Fisher. Yes, I think we made the same comment that, hey, someone, Scotty got some time. Not only did he get good screen time, but he actually got to be the one who was hanging out with the girl this time.
Yes.
I don't know that he got the girl, though. I guess maybe you could imply at the end that they are still kind of hanging out.
Sort of, yes.
But at any rate...
We just have to hope he's not in the Neelix zone. But.
Oh, yes. That's true. It's going to turn out that Kiesler is actually stealing his thunder. Yeah. Sorry, buddy. Sorry, Scotty. But, okay, getting back to this whole parallel with Babylon 5. I'm curious your thoughts on that. Do you think you kind of agreed? Flush it out a little bit here.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things where I wasn't necessarily thinking of it as I was watching it, when it's brought up, certainly just in general, I mean, the whole idea of the Vorlons and the bringers as the bringers of order, and the comparison with the Federation is one that I have thought of in thinking between of Babylon 5 and in relation to Star Trek, certainly riffing on that, the Sheridan kicking both of them out of the universe. Even at times have seen as Babylon 5 and JMS's way of sort of saying it's yes, well, we have these classic modes of science fiction where there's scientists who are all completely good and in the service of order and completely bad people, and those are both kind of caricatures, and we need to kick them out of our universe so we can do real stories. So it does appeal to my to one of my off the wall interpretations of Babylon 5.
Well, it's interesting to note, especially in relation to JMS, as you were just saying, that technically speaking, he did make a pitch once for a Star Trek series. And if I recall correctly, I mean, it would almost be a given that some of his story exploration would have been, what is the good of the Federation and, what are they spreading out there? Because there is so much, as Bronstam has said, as he's been watching the original series and so forth on Facebook, there is a lot of colonialism.
Oh, yeah.
In the original series and in the Federation's mindset. Something that they tried to tackle later on. But there is always that undercurrent in Star Trek that the Federation equals good.
Yes.
That them going around and convincing everybody to be friends with the Federation, or even better, to join the Federation, is the best possible outcome. And yeah, it's hard not to think that maybe there is a little bit of chaos versus order in that thinking, where should it be that way? Because even the Vulcans have the philosophy of infinite diversity and infinite combination. But it's hard to say that the Federation is full of chock full of diversity. There is some kind of homogeneity there that gets kind of thrown into it. And in fact, I mean, some of the later shows, Deep Space Nine in particular, and some of the others, have kind of explored that idea. Like, is it right for Bajor, for instance, to join the Federation, or are they going to give something up in that? Is what they gain better than what they lose? It's a really good question, and I don't think it gets explored enough, because the people behind it probably think, should we be questioning the core of our entire franchise? Like, should we be basically telling people after 50 years, you know what, the Federation is a bunch of crap? Probably not.
Yeah.
But because it always comes back to, yes, they are better than they are than their flaws would suggest. But I do think that that would have been some ground that JMS would have probably gone down, and I'm betting that that's at least one reason why they didn't even listen to him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're going in another direction. Of course you are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, well, I mean, it was always, I think, First Contact when Picard always gave what I thought was sort of the seminal Gene Roddenberry utopian vision of, the Federation, is this sort of shining city on the hill where they managed to overcome all of the economic and racial differences, et cetera. It's always been at the core of the Star Trek ethos, and I do not really have a problem with that. It's just one way of doing things. But I do think it's been interesting as later creators have come in and they have tried to do a little more commentary and a little more analysis of that situation, but I really think at its core Star Trek is just one of those artifacts where this is the optimistic vision, and you can bring certain darker elements and crises of conscience and certainly the hard decisions in the midst of war that they brought into to Deep Space Nine, but in a way you cannot necessarily go too far against that core vision without it just sort of not being that essential Star Trek optimism.
Yeah, I mean that is kind of the problem, right? If you go too far, then you lose something of Star Trek. That said, I think that this film probably went further than we've seen in a while. This is the kind of questioning I think that Insurrection was supposed to bring up.
Yes. Yeah.
And completely flopped in doing so. But I think even here they probably glossed over it a little bit more than they had to, more than I wanted them to. I think that all things being equal, it would have been really interesting for them to completely delve into this whole idea of, they kind of went like that. I mentioned that it's in one of the episodes in the third season, I think, and I forget mm-hmm. which one it's called, where they've got basically the Americans versus the communists.
Yeah, no, the Yangs and the Combs.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Right. And it's so obvious that the whole idea of the Federation is the U.S. Right.
Yes.
I mean, come on, it's beaten into your head. And of how do you then take that and the kind of modern interpretation of, yes, while the U.S. is certainly a benefit to so many and so many good things, we've got to look back at our history and say, yeah, we were pretty imperialist.
Mm-hmm.
And if that same basis is in the Federation, because that was at the core of the thought process for the creators of the show and the franchise and everything, as you say, yes, it's very optimist, but it's very optimist from a particular point of view. So it would have been interesting for them, 50 years later to really revisit that and have it be more blatantly about what is on the frontier. The one thing that I think maybe was not in the film that might have worked better as an I definitely see the analog of the Federation to the Vorlons. What I don't think is as clear is Krall and his people as analogs to the Shadows. Because while they in effect were the same and were speaking to some of the same things, we never really got to see how they were representative of anything. It was a very specific scenario. Mm-hmm. And while I really enjoyed that scenario, I think it still would have been even better if it had been a completely alien civilization that was even, I don't know how they would have done this entirely in a film, but, an alternative to the Federation even. So you really get that strong line of an equal but opposing point of view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that's what the Shadows were. I mean, the Shadows were such a threat because they were so ubiquitous, and I mean, even visually they did manage to get some of that across in the Swarm. I definitely see that. But I feel like the philosophical underpinning was not as strong as one could say, the order that the Federation brings to the galaxy. right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I wasn't seeing as necessarily a direct analogy, but certainly that sense of colony that was trying to be a counterweight imposition of the Federation's way of thinking, but you're right that certainly they were no way, or at least not at this point a full blown counterbalance to what the Federation are doing.
No, I don't think that it could have been, or it would have needed a lot more setup somewhere along the line.
Yep.
I guess the only way that you could have really pulled that off is if you had, say, the Klingons and the Romulans banding together with a couple other people.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like, it's not exactly like this in the novels, but, there's the whole Typhon Pact thing, which was supposed to basically represent an opposing force, both economically and philosophically, where, the member states have a lot more autonomy and things of that nature. And you almost get a little bit of shades of, yes, the post-Cold War situation, but you also got kind of those same feelings of, well, the difference between a strong federalist government versus a more of a confederacy. Very broad strokes, of course, I'm speaking here.
Sure.
But even that didn't really touch on order versus chaos in any specific way. I do like where those shades were in the film, though, and I do appreciate that did kind of lend itself to it, to that kind of analysis, or at least that kind of comparison. I mean, how often do we say that, Star Trek and Babylon 5 could align in that fashion? I mean, it would have been interesting to see if, in fact, just to go down this tangent a little bit, but what if Babylon 5 had, as some people claim, been originally envisioned as a kind of next step in the Star Trek universe?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that could be very interesting to consider in light of the Federation as kind of the at least influenced by the Vorlon side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, no, well, and certainly, I mean, that whole idea of taking, the series we've seen, had these other alien races that were more antagonists, but still took place largely sort of within the Federation, within the bubble of the Prime Directive and the way the Federation sees things, and taking this idea of really looking at the frontier, and if you're out there in these real first contact situations and dealing with other races and ambassadors, and so it's a situation that is more fluid, and where you are dealing with other points of view. You can certainly see where that concept could be used to introduce other ways of approaching the universe and life, and how those might interact and conflict with the Federation view of things. As you said, I mean, it may have been precisely because the concept had that capacity to sort of call some of the core beliefs into question that was something Paramount was at the time not ready to indulge as much.
Mm, exactly. It is interesting and kind of a conclusion here that our overall reaction was actually that Beyond was a great representation of original series storytelling. Mm-hmm. So in the end, the 50th anniversary kind of wound up, despite bringing all these questions to bear, kind of reaffirming one of those central tenets of the Star Trek universe, which is, no, it's kind of a given. The Federation is the good guys.
Yes.
So, I mean, how could it not be with someone like Kirk as a captain in Starfleet? Come on. All right, that was pretty much his feedback. So, I guess for right now, the last thing that we can do here is get into a little bit of open topics. And what have you been up to the last couple of weeks, Edmund?
Other than I did take a quick trip up to New York City to celebrate my mother's birthday. It was one of those ones of the zero, but like all great actresses, she never reveals her actual age. So just that it was one of those ones topping off a decade is all I will say. Part of all that also meant some hanging around in airports and getting lots of time to catch up on some reading. The main part of which was finishing off American Gods. That book really did grab a hold of me. The more I got into it, the more and more excited I got about Brian Fuller being the one to take on this property. Once I had finished the book, I did finally actually watch the Starz trailer, which I can now tell you in terms of spoiler warnings. I can tell that they're basically taking stuff just from the opening episodes, because nothing that happens in that trailer isn't something that you don't find out within about 20 pages of the opening of the book. So what you are seeing there is the opening, the way Shadow Moon's story sort of flits back and forth between what's happening in the real world, so to speak, such as it is, some of the more fantastical realms that get evoked and visited. Everything Brian Fuller was doing on Hannibal in terms of visions and hallucinations and interactions back and forth between the corporal plane and what is happening psychologically or in other realms, especially with it being on Starz and him and his creative team really having their head. Let's just say very optimistic about what they can come up with, and really fascinated to see how the visions in Brian Fuller and company's head match up with the ones that the book was invoking in mine.
I'm glad that you got far enough into it that you definitely see the potential there.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yep. All right. Anything else?
That was the primary thing. Although I did indulge in something I try and do whenever I'm up in New York City, and that is to try and see a film that I can only see on a screen in New York. And I think I pulled it off this time, because the IFC Center down in the Village was showing John Waters' hardly ever screened second feature, Multiple Maniacs. So I did get to see Divine as the purveyor of the cavalcade of perversions, in which they rope in suburban visitors, rob them, and then possibly kill them and go on the lam.
Okay. I had never actually heard of that one before.
It was his sophomore outing, and while it was a lot of fun seeing all of the Mink Stole and Divine and a lot of the other John Waters stock players, it's not quite as polished as some of his other early features. But still a heck of a lot of fun to see, and especially getting the chance to actually see it on the big screen in the dark with fellow John Waters fans, so we could hiss and laugh at the appropriate times.
There you go. Can't ask for more than that. All right, as far as I was concerned, I kind of went over a lot of it last time, but it's in terms of what I was doing while I was away, I actually got to finish the Star Trek novel that I was reading, The Ladder Fire by James Swallow. Another tale that really captures the feel and the ethics, I guess you could say, of the original series extremely well. I usually do not like that particular author, but this time I feel like he did a really nice job of representing the time period that he was writing in. And then also there was I got to read most of, I am literally like 10 pages away from the end, so I'm pretty sure that I've got it done at this point, as within the next day, of Jim Butcher's The Aeronauts Windless, which was the first book of the Cinder Spires. It's one that came out a little while ago, and I put it down when I was about halfway through, and I just could not get into it. However, this seemed to be, I guess, much better timing, because I plowed through it pretty well And like I said, I'm just about done, and I'm really liking it. It kind of clicked with me this time, and I'm looking forward to whenever the second volume comes out. But yeah, that's both recommended. If you're a Star Trek novel fan, The Ladder of Fire is a really good original series tale. And if you're a fan of Jim Butcher and you haven't checked out his new series, I would recommend that you do so. Other than that, I am trying to, little by little, get back into a rhythm with my comic book reading. I've been off the wagon again, about a month behind, but should be able to catch up in short order. I hope so, especially since I'll be on vacation, so I'll have a little bit of extra time to do things like that. But yeah, that's about all I can think of. I was hoping that I would try just once to get to try and get on my Vita while I was in China and see if I could connect to my PS4 all the way across the other side of the world, but I never quite got time to do that. So getting onto the Wi-Fi was a little trickier than that would have allowed, so unfortunate. But oh, well. Maybe next time.
I was about to say, yeah, you will be getting another opportunity, you hope.
Yes, indeed. But that is it on my side. I really haven't had a lot. Oh, well, I shouldn't say that. I did actually see a movie. I saw the Ratchet & Clank movie, finally.
Ah.
And I kind of understand why it came and went with so little fanfare. As a fan of the franchise, I definitely enjoyed it. It was cool to see the elements from the first game kind of remixed, as I knew that they would be, with some of the elements from later on. It was definitely something that I could tell was written by the people who wrote the game. However, it was also a little generic. Other films have done similar things with a lot more finesse, I think. And if you didn't know who these characters were, I don't think you would have seen this movie and or the trailer for that movie, let alone the first 15-20 minutes of the movie, and really felt like you were hooked into something really big. I think it was a great product for the already converted. So if you love the franchise, if you're a big fan of Ratchet & Clank, or you were, this will probably hit you in that sweet spot. You'll probably really enjoy it. If you don't know anything about them, I don't know that you're going to care at all, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had an opportunity here, and I think maybe they swung and missed. But yeah, I was watching it, and I kept waiting for that moment when it would go and kick into high gear for me, and it never did. It just was kind of there. And I think it's telling that the game based on the movie based on the game was a huge seller, but the movie kind of just happened. So, in fact, if I go and I look it up now, I bet you it didn't really do very well in the theater or even make a splash at all. Yeah, unfortunately, it made a total of maybe $9 million.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. I mean, I will say it's a game where it's certainly not something I've played or really had much interaction with. I mean, it's a name I've seen, and then I did see the trailer a couple of times on no doubt while seeing one of those other movies we discussed earlier in the week. But yes, as somebody who didn't really have any connection to the game, I know the trailer did not really grab me.
No, and it apparently didn't grab anybody else. I mean, this has to be one of those films they consider to be a bit of a flop.
Yeah,
because it just came and went with pretty much. I other than the other devoted Ratchet & Clank fans, I don't know anyone else who saw it, which kind of tells the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. I also did watch watching the first season of Noragami. It was pretty good. What was probably even more hilarious was the fact that as I was watching the last few episodes sitting on a plane, were the number of people behind me that I knew were watching. And I was like, so I've got Chinese people behind me watching Japanese anime with English subtitles.
Yes.
It was only appropriate then that when I got to the hotel and checked out what was on TV, I noticed there was an entire channel of Japanese anime with Chinese subtitles. It's like, okay. That must have been what it felt like for the people watching over my shoulder.
Yes.
But all right. And as Adam from Anime Jam Session put it, how about back in the late 90s when you had anime in Japanese with subtitles in English that were translated from the Chinese?
Right.
That just completes the loop.
Yeah. Yeah. And usually just run through the, well, whatever the equivalent then was of Google Translate. And just...
As I said, Adam, that explains so much.
Yeah.
But there we are. That was it for me as far as stuff that I was doing outside of traveling and working and watching the shows for this. So that wraps up our week. We are going to try and have some episodes out while we are away. Well, I'm away at least before I manage to get to Dragon Con. And then, of course, the week of Dragon Con, we will not have any episodes out that week.
Nope.
But hopefully between now and then, we will continue to have episodes out roughly on the normal schedule. So any last thoughts, Edmund?
No. With all that you're bringing up, I think one or both of us needs to start thinking about packing.
I think that may be true. So, all right, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.